talk about ratings.
Oh, he talks about ratings every day. He looks at his ratings every single day. But it's funny because our parents, like, I want somebody ask, who's watching?
Who's watching?
Yeah,
right.
Who's watching which TV?
Yeah.
You know, but it goes back to, like, you know, I was just in the building with some of the winners, and, like, mm-hmm. they got a chance to bring an individual. Mm-hmm. And some of the guys brought their wives,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of them brought their parents.
I got you.
And it was that reminder. And that's what Tim Tebow said, too. He's like, hey, congrats to you guys, but congrats to the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right? My parents are watching my brother and I on TV, and they're like, man, we're so proud. I imagine these parents are seeing their sons saying, man, I'm so proud mm-hmm. of my son for the work that he did on the field, in the classroom, but in the community.
So did you ask Sonny and Christy who they watched that evening?
I didn't ask. They're actually in Nigeria now. They're at the hospital. They're at the Living Hope Medical Center trying mm-hmm. to make sure everything's situated there.
Okay. A yeah. couple of more questions. Also being an ambassador for the International Justice
Mission.
And we talked about that the last time we spoke a couple of years ago. Tell our audience about that.
Yeah, so the International Justice Mission is the largest anti-human trafficking mm-hmm. organization in the world. And so it goes back to, once again, like, who are you and why are you here? And speak up for those who can't speak up for themselves. And that's what Tim spoke on as well. Like, hey, speak up. And so I've got a chance to be an ambassador for them and to speak up for the millions of people who are trapped in human trafficking, right? Whether it's online sexual exploitation, whether it's police abuse of power, we get a chance to speak up for them and to stand up.
How do you manage all the time, all the different organizations and functions that you're participating in on a daily basis? It's not weekly. This is a daily yeah. thing for you.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is seasons, right? So, like, there for a season or a few seasons, I was a big ambassador for IJM.
Okay.
And that was great. And this year, you know, I've kind of stepped away and doing different things. I'm still mm-hmm. an advocate. But now I get a chance to be an ambassador for the All-State AFCA Good Works team, like, for this season and hopefully for more. We're talking, Tim's been here for 7, 8, mm-hmm. 9 seasons. So it's like, man, I want to be a part of that. Because not just the work that you hear about, right? Even ESPN, I'm on ESPN, but I got a chance to meet the guys. Jamion Franklin, mm-hmm. I've talked about him over and over again. Now I'm seeing Jamion, right? Matthew Sindrick from Cal and the work that he's doing, right? I'm meeting these guys, right? Ethan Downs, I'm meeting these guys. And so for me, I get a chance to pour in, like, be present where your feet are.
Mm-hmm.
I get a chance to pour into these guys because this organization, All-State AFCA Good Works team, and the people not only have poured into me, but are pouring into me by allowing me to come and to still be around and to speak up.
What is it like to come and, one, participate in this event, but the school in which you graduated from, the school in which you played on at a high level, this day and part of this week meant to you thus far?
Oh, it's been amazing. I was planning on coming anyways because of Allstate.
Mm-hmm.
And how much this event means to the team,
mm-hmm.
the 22 winners,
right.
Coaches, the All-State AFCA Good Works team. So I was going to be here by the grace of God anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I found out Texas was going to be in the game, for me it was just icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, sure, I'd love to watch. And then I found out I get a chance to cover the game with ESPN. I'll be doing the simulcast, the megacast on ESPN2, the field pass. So that's mm-hmm. just icing on the cake. But the reason I'm here is because the All-State AFCA Good Works team and those young men who are part of that team now. Texas or not, I'd have been here for that.
So how do you control that objectivity?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. Because for the most part, I try to be objective, especially with my role at ESPN.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But the hard part is, like, you meet some people, right? Like, even like, I'm like, man, I started rooting for Jamion
mm-hmm.
at Duke. Because I'm like, oh, man, this dude can play. Oh, man, he's on the team. So I started rooting for him. Right, Matthew Sindrick, I'm rooting for these guys. And so I think for that piece, it's a little bit, I'm not going to say hard, it's real because, like, man, you know people. And then with Texas as well, I've got a chance to cover the team, so I know them. And, you know, but it's hard because you watch tape. You're like, hey, man, I want to say what the tape says. So I don't know. I'm definitely, you know, I want Texas to win, right, just from a selfish perspective. Mm-hmm. But I'm also just glad that they were able to make it
this one,
you know,
right.
and then I want them to finish, right? Just like we told the guys, like, hey, congrats, you made it. But this is just a beginning, right? We're not just saying it. We're doing it. Tomorrow we'll be at the Saints facility working with Son of a Saint. In 5 years, these guys might be winning Walt Payton Man of the Year awards. In 10 years, they might be starting their own nonprofits. That is just a beginning. And so I'm excited about Texas being here. But I want them to finish.
Final question, Sam. In looking at all the things you've done and currently are doing, it seems that you have an affinity for young people. Why so?
I love There's a verse that says, speak up for those who can't speak up for themselves in Proverbs, chapter 30. Mm-hmm. For the rights of all who are destitute, speak up and just fairly defend the rights of the poor and the needy. So whether it's young or old, right? We work in the Louisiana State Penitentiary, mm-hmm. over in Nigeria.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. corporate media's story about Haiti is familiar. Haiti, according to various recent reports, has whipped from one calamity to another. The country is a cataclysm of hunger and terror, teetering on the brink of collapse, spiraling deeper into chaos, or else descending into gang-fueled anarchistic chaos. It's become a dangerously rudderless country. According to one Florida paper's editorial, Haiti's unrest is now becoming our problem as, quote, Floridians and the U.S. struggle to help people in Haiti, although history suggests there are no answers, close quote. Or, well, there is one answer. The Washington Post made space for a former ambassador to explain that 20 years ago in Haiti, quote, the worst outcomes were avoided through decisive American intervention. Today's crisis might require it as well, close quote. At this point, the Austin American Statesman's Haiti cannibalism claims unfounded might pass for refreshing. AP had a piece that actually talked to Haitians amid what is indeed a deep and deepening crisis. A grandmother told the wire service, we're living day by day and hoping that something will change. We will talk about what has to change, including, importantly, Western media presentations that ignore or erase even recent history, with Chris Bernadel from the Black Alliance for Peace, Haiti America's team, and Haitian grassroots group Mulligoff. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. Elon Musk, the right-wing anti-union billionaire owner of Twitter, recently rebranded as X, has cast himself as a free speech crusader against censorship in Brazil. Such framing is, unsurprisingly, BS. It's instead a political crusade by a capitalist to use social media to reshape global politics in favor of the right. And as Ari Paul writes for Fair.org, it's important that we all understand why that is. So, as Reuters reported, Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes ordered the blocking of certain accounts on Twitter, which led Musk to announce that Twitter would defy the judge's orders because they were unconstitutional, and to call for Moraes' resignation. It's not clear which accounts are being targeted, but the judge is investigating digital militias that have been accused of spreading fake news and hate messages during Bolsonaro's term, as well as probing an alleged coup attempt by Bolsonaro. The AP reported that the judge opened up an inquest into Musk directly, saying that the media mogul, quote, began waging a public disinformation campaign regarding the top court's actions, close quote. Musk says that his valiant, self-sacrificing effort is in the name of free speech, telling the Wall Street Journal, quote, we will probably lose all revenue in Brazil and have to shut down our office there, close quote. But, quote, principles matter more than profit, close quote. For those not already gagging, remember that Musk's Twitter has been eager to censor content at the request of the Indian government, including a BBC documentary that was critical of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. India under Modi has seen a steep decline in press freedom, troubling journalists around the world, but out of the same mouth used to pretend to defend free speech in Brazil, Musk was bragging about traveling to India to meet with Modi. Musk censored Twitter content in the Turkish election in response to a request from Turkish President Recep Erdogan, saying, quote, "The choice is to have Twitter throttled in its entirety or limit access to some tweets. Which one do you want?" Close quote. Turkey is almost synonymous at this point with speech suppression. It ranks 165 out of 180 on Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index. But Musk didn't seem to feel the need to intervene to save democracy there. The impact of Musk's decision to censor Twitter when it comes to Turkey and India isn't just that it exposes his duplicity when it comes to free speech. It robs the global public of vital points of view when it comes to those countries. In essence, the crime isn't so much that Musk is hypocritical, but that his administration of the social media site has kept readers in the dark rather than expanding their worldview. The context in Brazil is that in the last presidential election in 2022, leftist challenger Lula da Silva ousted Bolsonaro, who has since been implicated in a failed coup attempt resembling the January 6th, 2021 riot here. The Washington Post reported that social media in Brazil were, quote, flooded with disinformation, along with calls in Portuguese to stop the steal, close quote, and also demands for a military coup in response to a possible Lula victory. Since then, tech companies have bristled at Brazil's attempt to curb the influence of fake news, including a bill that would put the onus on the internet companies, search engines, and social messaging services to find and report illegal material. And while those problems extend to various online media, a source told The Washington Post that they coincided with Musk firing people in Brazil who moderated content on the platform to catch posts that broke its rules against incitement to violence and misinformation. Lula's victory was a source for hope for Brazil's poor and working class and a blow to the kind of right-wing despotism espoused by people like Bolsonaro, who represents a past of U.S.-aligned terror states that use military force to protect U.S. interests and suppress egalitarian movements. That's why Brazilian Report, for example, says that Musk is joining a campaign led by the Brazilian far right. And it's why the Wall Street Journal writes that, quote, "Supporters of right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro, who gave Musk a medal during his visit in 2022 to announce plans to install satellites over the Amazon rainforest, have reveled in Musk's defiance, declaring him a hero as the dividing lines in Brazil's culture wars deepen," close quote. So Elon Musk isn't just being a high-profile hypocrite when he pretends to fight for free speech in Brazil, while Twitter censors speech when it comes to India and Turkey. As Ari Paul notes, he's actually being consistent in his quest to use his corporate wealth to alter the political landscape against liberal democracy and towards a dark and despotic future. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Columnist Clarence Page reflects U.S. liberal media's understanding of Haiti with a piece headlined, "Haiti's Tragic History Just Keeps Repeating Itself." The Biden administration, Page writes, shows little appetite to become deeply immersed in perennially troubled Haiti. And it's no secret that many Americans have grown weary of trying to solve too many of the world's problems. The Hill notes that more than 5 million Haitians out of a population of 11 million are at stage 3 and 4 levels of hunger, the fifth stage being famine. The U.S., described as one of the largest donors for Haiti, is reporting difficulties in delivering aid, but bravely plans no change in strategy to address the crisis. A piece in The Plain Dealer suggests why we should care. Haiti's economic, social, and environmental meltdown is sure to reach our shores. So yes, you can learn something about Haiti's current crisis and the U.S. view of it from the news media. What you won't learn about are the roots of the crisis, much less how they can be traced back to the U.S. Chris Bernadelle works with the Black Alliance for Peace, Haiti America's team, and the Haitian grassroots organization Molagas. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chris Bernadelle.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
The first, if not the only thing, that many U.S. citizens will take away from media coverage about Haiti today is that gang violence is terrorizing the capital, Port-au-Prince. But when Americans think about gangs, their image is generally of poor, young, probably urban people, disaffected, unemployed, who are just grabbing whatever weapons they can and sticking up people on the street for money and for kicks. But that doesn't really properly convey who the gangs right now in Haiti are or where they come from, does it?
No, not at all. And in the history of Haiti, there have been a number of times when armed groups have been involved in the political situation. These armed groups, or paramilitaries, as I like to call them, are funded by the ruling elite of Haitian society, the ruling elite that controls the ports, families like the Bijou family, and they're made up of many of the young men from the poorest areas of the Haitian capital and other parts of Haiti. But many of the members and leadership of these groups are former police, former military. Some of them have military training. So to call them gangs is a mistake. And I would say the proper characterization is paramilitary groups, armed groups, and they're carrying out the interests of the ruling Haitian financial elite who have controlled Haiti's economy for a long time.
Haiti doesn't manufacture guns, right? So the guns are coming from somewhere else.
Exactly. The guns are coming from the United States. Most are coming through Miami, through these privately owned ports, or ports that are owned by these wealthy families. And they're being disseminated around the poor neighborhoods in order to carry out the political objectives or try to carry out the political objectives of different sections of Haiti's ruling elite. So they'll arm one group to attack another group, and they'll, you know, have groups protect certain areas and not go into other areas. But these armed paramilitary groups, for the most part, are carrying out the interests of the ruling elite.
Well, let's talk about the so-called political landscape. The Caribbean Community and Common Market, CARICOM, has put forth a proposal for a transitional government that The Hill, just for one example, says, quote, will be key to efforts to put Haiti on the path to restore security and wrestle control back from the gangs, close quote. Well, you've already complicated the gangs part of that. But what is the response of Haiti advocates to this CARICOM proposal, both what it says and, you know, the way it came about?
This CARICOM proposal is a new face for the same process, the same kind of thing that's been going on. The main issue with Haiti, the main problem in Haiti, are not these armed groups, not these paramilitaries, as is being portrayed. The main problem continues to be what it's been, specifically since the 2004 coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide. So the main problem in Haiti is the international community, the so-called core group, U.S. foreign policy, implementing their will in Haiti and not allowing for Haitian society to develop a government and a civil society that serves their interests and their needs. The constant interventions, starting with the Munista intervention in 2004 that lasted into 2017, which pretty much laid the ground for the crisis we have in Haiti today. That situation removed all what was left of a legitimate Haitian government. We went from a period where we had around 7,000 elected officials to today where we have zero elected officials in power. We've gone from one version of the PHTK to another, First one being delivered to us by Hillary Clinton when she flew into Haiti to ensure that Michel Martelly would be able to pursue the presidency, and then followed by Jovenel Moïse, and then with Ariel Henry. And now that they've forced Ariel Henry to step down in order to implement this transitional council, we're seeing more of the same. These are the same political actors, the same political class that the Haitian people have shown time and time again they do not trust, and they see them as foreign actors, people acting on the behalf of foreign interests.
You know, I know that a lot of listeners don't know the deep history of U.S. intervention in Haiti and international intervention in Haiti. I would ask them to look back to 1791, you know, and George Washington's promise to help the French quell the alarming insurrection of the Negroes, you know, or they can look up the 1915 to 1934 occupation. Or, you know, right up to the 2015 Politico headline calling Bill and Hillary Clinton the king and queen of Haiti. But it is, of course, as you're saying, the 2004 coup, that the role of that can't be overstated. And I guess what I want to say is, like, if you have an illegitimate result, an illegal action, and then that leads to other illegal actions, it doesn't get cleansed along the way because the facts on the ground change. There is no way to understand Haiti's present without understanding its history.
Exactly. And the problem in Haiti is a socioeconomic problem as far as the structure of Haiti's economy, the way that the economy has been artificially propped up to support foreign enterprises and carry out the interests of the core group, primarily France, Canada, the United States. And also, the United States has plans to carry out, using the 2019 Global Fragility Act, the United States has plans to carry out further intervention in Haiti and to further diminish the sovereignty of the Haitian people by implementing more unelected governments, putting people into position without any legitimacy, without any constitutional reasoning, without any constitutional legality. They're putting these people into office. And what's even more outrageous, now that the CARICOM community now is acting in the same way that the core group has been acting in Haiti, they place a requirement on all members of the so-called transitional council where they must accept foreign military intervention in order to be a part of this council. So this council is a U.S. idea and is being dictated by the United States and the State Department, as well as CARICOM. And it's not in the interest of the Haitian people. The Haitian people have already rejected many of these actors that are taking seats on this council. A requirement to be in this transitional council, who will be selecting the next leader, de facto leader of Haiti, is to accept this foreign military occupation, this occupation that the U.S. has been trying to arrange, that has been characterized by some as a U.N. intervention, but it is not a U.N. intervention. The U.N. won't be sending in anyone. The U.S. got the Security Council to rubber stamp this Kenyan police force that they're funding to come into the country. And so, with the disaster that was the MINUSTAH occupation of 2004 to 2017, where they unleashed cholera into the country and killed over 10,000 people, as many as 30,000 people killed by cholera released into the country by UN peacekeepers, so-called. Now, the U.S., for this intervention that they're planning, it won't even be a UN force officially. So whatever accountability that came along with a UN force being sent to the country, now that won't even be there. Now they were attempting to get a Kenyan force brought into the country, and they've faced some roadblocks with that, political and logistical, I'm sure. And now they are propping up this council to cover up for what they were trying to do under Ariel Henry, which they now see was impossible. They're trying to do the same thing now under this council that they're controlling.
With the Global Fragilities Act, that is, like, supposedly it's about, you know, countries that are prone to instability or something. I don't know what the language says, without any understanding of what it is that is introducing instability to these places, you know. And this is a new face, but what I hear you saying is it's a new face on an old story, really. It's the same thing.
Exactly right. So-called fragile states, countries prone to instability, conflict, and poverty, are being framed as threats to U.S. security. And the Global Fragility Act is a means for them to more easily send out their resources and institutions from the Defense Department, the State Department, USAID, and the Treasury, so-called international allies and partners, to deal with these situations. So this is just a new form of what they did in 1915 when they invaded the country and had to come up with excuses and reasons to cover up their real motivations. Same thing in 2004 when they did the coup d'etat against Aristide. And now again, we're seeing the same type of intervention into Haitian politics, Haitian society, where the Haitian people, the masses of Haitian people, who for years have been coming out into the streets demanding a transition to a democratic government that represents their interests, the United States and their allies are doing the same thing they've been doing this whole time, implementing a foreign force, implementing foreign control over Haitian government and policy, and the results won't be any different. Now what we're seeing with these so-called gangs, what we call armed groups and paramilitaries, are another way to find a reason to intervene into the country. But it's not just as simple as that, because the dynamics of Haitian society, where you have a tiny ruling class propped up by this international community, but that really runs things from the shadows and plays the role of doing, you know, the dirty business for the U.S., for the imperialist powers of the world, to control and dominate Haitian society. They have, in the past and today, have found it convenient to fund armed groups, desperate young men in poor neighborhoods, but also, like I mentioned earlier, people who come from the military or the former military, people who come from the police, to enact their interests and will in this situation.
Well, I think folks are going to read media and they're going to hear talk about the transitional committee in government and all of these machinations as being about supporting Haitian sovereignty, you know, and sovereignty is thrown around with reference to officials who have been essentially appointed or installed by the U.S. and international powers. And so every time we talk about sovereignty in Haiti, we're kind of reifying this fiction of what's going on. Yeah, it's deeply misleading.
Yes, that's exactly right. They did this with Ariel Henry, where they propped up Ariel Henry for months and months and months, even though the people of Haiti were demonstrating in the street, coming out against every policy that he ever put out, coming out against the de facto ruler that was imposed on them that had no constitutional authority. And when they reached the end of that rope, when they saw that the situation had gone too far and the armed groups had taken the step to actually keep Henri from re-entering the country, they now have transitioned to a new strategy with this presidential council or this transitional council, which will be more of the same.
Well, let me ask you finally, what do real ways forward look like and what must they include?
Real ways forward must include the Haitian people being able to take control of this transition process. After the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, and even before that, like we spoke about before, with the coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the Haitian government, the Haitian state, has been pretty much destroyed by foreign powers. And the Haitian people have the right to go through their own process, their own domestic process, to develop a solution. There are Haitian political organizations like Molagaf who are on the ground working with workers, students, people in the neighborhoods affected by some of this violence. There are other organizations throughout the country. And another thing as well, Haiti is not just Port-au-Prince. There are many other regions where the security situation is not the same, but the political and economic situation due to the situation in the capital, Port-au-Prince, is deteriorating. But it's not the entire country is in the same situation as Port-au-Prince. But the Haitian people have the will and the right to work through their own process to come up with a transition to get back to a constitutional government and a sovereign democratic state where they can make decisions for themselves. So it's up to us, allies of the Haitian people, to call out the U.S., to see through their different tactics, like what they want to do with the Global Fragility Act, what they've been doing with this transitional council, their plans to bring Kenyan troops into Haiti as a blackface cover for U.S. imperialism. We have to call them out. We have to hold them accountable. And we also have to support organizations in Haiti like Molagaf, and we have to support the Haitian people in general to allow them the space to develop a transition, to develop a solution to these problems. And they can do it. The United States, the foreign powers, the core group will continue to intervene and try to control the process. But as we've seen, things have gotten out of hand. They can't predict what's going to happen next, and they can't control the situation. So they're trying to look for new versions of the same solution they've always proposed to the situation, which is them dominating. So now the Haitian people have an opportunity to develop their own processes, their own solutions, and it's going to be up to them. All we can do is keep the U.S. government out of it and try our best to keep the U.S. government from overthrowing whatever democratic, sovereign form of Haitian government that can come out of that process.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Chris Bernadel from the Black Alliance for Peace, Haiti America's team, as well as Molagas, a Haitian grassroots organization. You can find information about what we're talking about online at blackallianceforpeace.com. Chris Bernadel, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter Extra or to show support for Counterspin and FAIR if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Al-Ateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Al-Ateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
Think about your mother, your sister, your girlfriend. One in six women is a victim of sexual assault. Now think about your father, your brother, your best friend. Men are victims too. Rape can happen to anyone. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, encouraging you to call the National Sexual Assault Hotline to learn how to support someone you love. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAIN.org.
Brought to you by RAIN and this state.
I'm here outside when you're ready. When you're ready for me. Bring out the shots and confetti. I'll take you home if you let me. Yeah. Just promise you won't forget me. No, cause the days get better when you're here. So I gotta keep you near. Just can't get you out of my head.
I am calm. day will be the day. Was made to dream that anything can be my home. I found my home. Today will be the day it all will change.
Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
Charlie pull it with sing a song. Didn't go ask you. Let me cry. Let me cry. With the
Good evening. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to our live edition of Ebony Spectrum.
Right.
Rick and I haven't been here in the studio for a while together, and we have a special guest, so we're going to talk to our special guest in just a minute. But I just want to remind you that we are live, and we're here at 88.3 FM and on the web at www.wrct.org in case you're streaming. So we have a special guest in the studio. Yes, sir.
No, I was just going to say, do you want me to, let's see, I won't scat it, but I'll hum our theme song?
No.
No, you don't want that to happen? Okay. And, I just want to say it's great to be on live radio.
Well, Rick is back over the same old tricks.
So, bigger and better in some ways. But that's such a distinct, and I'm telling you, the godfather of radio in Pittsburgh here. And at least black folk doing radio, I'll put it out there. And there's others, that can share that light. But you certainly have had the background in the years you and I have worked together.
Yeah.
It's been tremendous. Yeah. But having done now podcasts, Zooms, and things like that.
Right.
And it's been several years. We were once in a small
studio.
Yeah. We did something. But it's been literally about 3 years.
Wow.
And live radio is an animal of its own.
Yes. So, it's fun.
I do want to make a tribute or acknowledge the passing of Joe Madison. That's the real godfather of talk radio.
Well, in the meanwhile, we also lost Dr. Ralph Proctor as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. As I told him, I grew up listening to you, Black Horizon.
Yeah, our good friend and mentor.
A lot of folk have passed on. So
yeah,
we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge that.
Yes. Yeah, also Bob Davidson, Soul Patrol passed away as well. So we've lost a lot of folks here and there. We try to keep it moving, try to keep positive. I posted something today about depression online, so I hope people get a chance to read that, because it's a time of everyone's going through various things in their lives, pandemic or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's life in general, but life moves on for us that are still living in, but we remember those from the past as well. Mm-hmm. And we also find ways to cope with the various mechanisms that we encounter on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest today, Rick's going to introduce our guest. He's going to read her bio. And Dr. Etta L. Fields Black is our guest in the studio today, and we're going to be discussing her book, which is getting a lot of critical acclaim. She's going to all kinds of book signings and everything around the country, which is good to see. We've been in contact with each other for the past maybe 3 or 4 months, and I had to wait till she came back to town, and we were able to have her in the studio. But she wrote a great book on Harriet Tubman, and it's called Comanche River Raid. A lot of people aren't familiar with that. We're going to talk about that. And also we're going to talk about black freedom during the Civil War. Another thing that a lot of people aren't aware of, so we're going to be getting into that discussion. So,
we're going to do things a little different in a little ways. Some have interesting reasons to do it, like this mangled sheets of paper I have in front of me. But that's another story. Technology works well. And then I think we can, in an interesting way, and Dr. Fields Black, I would like you to help me make sure we get the pronunciation together.
Okay.
So this book is Comby, Harriet Tubman, The Comanche.
Comby.
Okay. Yeah. River Raid, Black Freedom During the Civil War, February 2024. It's brand new.
Yes, it's brand new.
Banking new. Mm-hmm. You are described.